That said, it's time for kids' church. They're heading on out. Let me invite you to turn to Exodus chapter 19 this morning. Exodus chapter 19. You know, is over the last couple of weeks, you may have noticed, I don't know if you noticed or not, maybe you know, you just thought he just always sounds like that, but over the last couple of weeks, I've been fighting a cold, and it's been kind of a difficult thing. I'm not a very good patient, you know, like, you know, when you're sick, you're supposed to do things like, you know, get more sleep, and so I got 4 hours of sleep last night, and you know, when you're sick, you're supposed to drink lots of fluid, so I drank more coffee. And things like that, all the things you're not supposed to do, I've been doing. And I really don't like being sick, and so I have a hard time surrendering to doing the things that I'm supposed to do when I am sick. But, you know, the thing is that whenever you get really sick, you know, sometimes you get knocked out of going someplace or doing what you would like to do or things like that, especially if you ever get contagious, you know, and then all of a sudden all of your plans that you had, you know, you're just like, and you feel fine. But you're contagious, so you can't go anywhere, you can't do anything. And, you know, there are times in life when you want to do things and you want to be places and you can't be there. You can't do the thing that you would like to do. You know, I think about times like when my loved ones have been here visiting me and they get on an airplane and I'm standing there and I can see the airplane, but I can't get to them because there's this thing called security between us and them, and I think, oh man, there they go, and I can remember even sitting at times on the airplane myself and looking at my family back when you could still go up before 9/11 and still, you know, see your family off, and I could see them in the window looking at me, and they couldn't see me because I'm in that little tinted window, little round window looking at them, but I could see them right there, and I was thinking about how much I missed them already as I sat there on the tarmac. Not too long ago, actually, I guess it was about 7 years ago, Dawn and I were dealing with paperwork for Emma, and I was in Mexico continually, had to stay in Mexico with her, could not leave her side even for a moment, really couldn't even leave her with a sitter because of rules about abandonment and orphans and things like that in Mexico. And so my family was over at our home in the United States taking care of things, keeping the home fires going there, making... They were doing a little bit of back and forth, but they were staying more in the United States. And I was continually, without interruption, in Mexico, right there by her side because I was able to do that. And so we were separated for sometimes weeks at a time because of the things they needed to take care of in terms of paperwork and things like that. And so we got right down to the wire, and actually it had been several weeks since I had seen my family. We just talked on the phone, and... we had to have a particular piece of paper, like now. Like it was now or wait another 6 weeks. And so I was like, I'm panicking, and she didn't have a cell phone and stuff. And so I'm calling the school, and I finally get through the school. I said, you've got to get Dawn to come to the office. It's an emergency. They finally get her to the office, and I said, I need you in the next hour to drive from the northeast side of El Paso all the way over to the east side of El Paso, get this piece of paper, make a copy, drive all the way to the border, and you've got to do it in under an hour. And I need you to meet me at the border crossing station on the Mexican side, not the U.S. side. You're going to walk up to the line, but you cannot cross, you cannot touch me, you cannot speak to me, because if you do, I'm in the United States, and we've abandoned our daughter. So she ran, and she did all those things. We raced to the border. It was a good 50 minutes just to get across town because there's no freeways for me to get just to the border while I was in Mexico. I get to the border. I walk over like I'm going to go into the United States, and then I stop, and I watch her come walking down just in time. I see her standing there, and those guards, the Mexican guards and the U.S. guards, are standing between us, and they said, remember, no talking. because technically you're on U.S. soil. There's just a line between you, but you're really on U.S. soil right now. If you touch her or talk to her, you're in the United States. Do not do either. She cannot hand you the piece of paper. If you touch the piece of paper while she's holding the piece of paper, you're in the United States, and you've got to go back, and you've got to abandon your daughter at the border. And I was going, oh, this is ridiculous. This is the stupidest bureaucratic, and I got to behave. Because we're like within hours of getting to go home if this works. And so we looked at each other through the barrier. They grabbed the piece of paper. They walk it the 2 feet to me, and I grabbed the piece of paper from the Mexican border agent, not the American border agent, because I can't even touch the American agent. And I grabbed that piece of paper, and I turn, and I run back through the crowds and into Mexico. And about 6 hours later, we were home, and Emma was in the United States for the very first time, and it was really cool. But I tell you what, even though we were inches apart and I wanted to be with her, I missed her a whole lot. I knew that the best thing I could do for all of us was not to touch her at that moment, not to speak to her at that moment. Sometimes we want something so bad, but there's something that stands in the way, either the goodness of wanting to adopt our daughter, maybe the kindness of not infecting the people around you, or maybe it's just a functional need to close doors, and so we say no or goodbye to something, even though it would be easier to continue on, but then we separate ourselves intentionally for one reason or another. You know, God has this incredible desire to be close to us, to make his dwelling among us. But there are obstacles to overcome. One of them being the issue of his holiness. And like it, the issue of our sinfulness. And then there's a number of functional issues as well. But still, here's the thing. The heart of God is to draw near and for us to be near to him, for his dwelling to be among us and our dwelling to be with him. And he has always wanted it that way. He has been determined to make it that way. And so he has in Jesus. But did you know that before we ever read the name of Jesus, it was always the heart of God? Take a look at Exodus 19, if you will, with me. Exodus chapter 19, beginning in verse 1. I'm going to read those 25 verses. I'll be reading from the English Standard Version. Please read along in whatever translation you have. And we read that on the third new moon after the people of Israel had gone out from the land of Egypt, on that day they came into the wilderness of Sinai. They set out from Rephidim and came into the wilderness of Sinai, and they camped in the wilderness. And there Israel encamped before the mountains while Moses went up to God. The Lord called to him out of the mountain, saying, "Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, tell the people of Israel, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my command, my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. And these are the words that I shall speak to the people of Israel." So Moses came and called the elders of the people and sat before them all these words that the Lord had commanded him. All the people answered together and said, "All that the Lord has spoken we will do." And Moses reported the words of the people to the Lord, and the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I'm coming to you in a thick cloud that the people may hear when I speak with you and may also believe you forever." When Moses told the words of the people to the Lord said to Moses, "Go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow and let them wash their garments and be ready for the third day. For on the third day, the Lord will come down on Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people, and you shall set limits for the people all around, saying, 'Take care not to go up into the mountain or touch the edge of it. Whoever touches the mountain shall be put to death. No hand shall touch him. he shall not be he shall be stoned or shot, whether beast or man, he shall not live. And when the trumpet sounds a long blast, they shall come up to the mountains. So Moses went down from the mountain to the people and consecrated the people, and they washed their garments. And he said to the people, be ready for the third day, and do not go near a woman. I could just really have a lot of fun with that right now, but I won't. Okay, so on the morning of the third day, there were thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud on the mountain and a very loud trumpet blast, so that all the people in the camp trembled. Then Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God, and they took their stand at the foot of the mountain. Now Mount Sinai was wrapped in smoke because the Lord had descended on it in fire, and the smoke of it went up like the smoke of a kiln, and the whole mountain trembled greatly as the sound of a trumpet grew louder and louder. And Moses spoke, and God answered him in the thunder, and the Lord came down on Mount Sinai to the top of the mountain, and the Lord called Moses to the top of the mountain. Moses went up, and the Lord said to Moses, go down and warn the people, lest they break through to the Lord to look, and many of them perish. Also, let the priests come near to the Lord and consecrate themselves, lest the Lord break out against them. And the Lord said, and Moses said to the Lord, the people cannot come up to Mount Sinai, for you yourself warned us, saying, set limits around the mountain and consecrate it. And the Lord said to him, go down and come up, bringing Aaron with you. But do not let the priest and the people break through to come up to the Lord, lest he break out against them. And so Moses went down to the people and told them. Now, I don't know about you, when I read that text, the first things that come to my mind is, it is, you know, God is in the lightning and looking frightening. It's this kind of imagery that is awe-provoking and a certain amount of fear that would go through us. Just the thought of a sight like that, of all the mountain rumbling and everything, those are powerful images. And the truth is that most of the time when you ask people about their imagery of God, unless they've been raised in a really grace-filled kind of environment, most people have a view of God of being something like that. You know, the mountains shaking and voices, you know, you never hear anybody, you know, pretend to be the voice of God and go, y'all come on in, right? I mean, you know, in fact, I think that's what's going to happen. I think we're going to get to heaven, and we're going to get there, and like Peter's going to open the gate, you know, and we're going to hear, y'all come on in, you know, just for fun. I don't know, like a Mickey Mouse voice, I don't know. I think just to mess with us. No? Okay. Well, anyhow, I'm kidding, but my point is that we have these imagery and we have this idea of what the voice of God is supposed to sound like. And a lot of it's based around this kind of imagery. When we think of God, a lot of times we think of the old man in the chair and things like that. We have this sense of awe and grandeur and might and majesty. We love images when we talk about Jesus as Christ the King. We even have churches called Christ the King Cathedral or Christ the King this or whatever. Images that we don't tend to identify a whole lot with, except in church. But even then, I rarely see windows dedicated to the whole idea of him being gentle as a lamb and things like that. We like the magnificent stuff. Lots of grandeur, power, Christ over the term Messiah, because Messiah sounds lowly and gentle, and Christ King. You know, we like those sounds. We like God to be big and powerful, and it's good. And, you know, over the course of our series here in Exodus, one of the major reminders that's been repeated over and over again is this sense of who God is and his grandeur and his power and his might to deliver them. And so it's natural that their first encounter with God would be along those same lines. I mean, they have been having these encounters with God at a distance, watching God work among the Egyptians, and God has met the Egyptians on their own terms and their idea about God being mighty and powerful. But remember this, and we've said this all through the series, Israel has been in Egypt 430 years, longer than, you know, you and I, our ancestors, have been in the United States of America. And so we don't think of ourselves as being Irish or German or African or whatever else our descendancy is. We think of ourselves as Americans because we've been here long enough. This is our culture. These are the people that we identify with. At no point in my life did I ever think, you know, like I would side with Ireland or Germany against the United States of America, even though that's my heritage, or with the French. Although I don't know how the French would wage a war anyhow. But no, that's another. Okay. So I can say I'm like a fourth French, okay? So I'm not. You know. Anyhow, my point being this. I don't identify with being French. I don't identify with being Irish. I don't identify with being German. I identify with being American because my family has lived in the United States. In fact, I identify with being Texas from Texan because my family's been in El Paso, Texas for over 100 years. They brought the railroad through El Paso, Texas. I still have family living there. I also have some family buried there, a lot of family buried there. And so the reality is for me is that that's home. Always, it'll always be in the back of my mind. This is home. The United States is home. It never crosses my mind. And so the Hebrews are Egyptians. They really are. Now, they have a different religion and things like that than the rest of the Egyptians, but they're Egyptians in their heart of hearts. That's what they identify with. And that's the God they've known. And they haven't had their Bible. Right now we're reading it, what's being written in the midst of that. And so they have been among these people. They are Egyptian by culture. They are somewhat even by religion. They know very little about Yahweh. They don't have a Bible yet. And even their standard forms of worship have been informed more by Egyptian religion than by any sense of what they know about God. They know almost nothing about Yahweh except that he was their God, and every concept about God has been based either on tradition or Egyptian religion. So when they've had these encounters with God and it's been awesome and majestic and terrible and frightening, it just makes sense that their first kind of encounter with God on the mountain is very much in the same way. There's no bait and switch here. They're going to learn some things about God along the way and learn about his mercy and his compassion. They've been learning some things about his mercy and compassion. They're going to learn more. But at this moment, when they're having this first encounter, I've been having a cold. but at this moment, as they're having this encounter, they're about to learn some things about God that they didn't know up to this point. One of the things that they're going to learn is that God is that awesome, frightening, and powerful God that that needs to be respected. It needs to be understood from the standpoint that he is powerful and that you don't approach God in a way that is contemptuous or nonchalant. And here's the thing is that kind of emphasizes that. Is not just the fact that there was the fear of dying if they touched the mountain. It's not just that God says to them, if people come up the mountain, they will die. But even look at the preparations that were involved in getting ready. Now, I know in the American culture, we have, you know, plans for getting ready for Sunday church services and things like that. For instance, you probably take your weekly bath on Saturday night. I know I do. Or something like that. Anyhow, we have a tendency to get all showered up and cleaned up and, you know, and gussied up, whatever you want to call it. Some churches even have what they call their Sunday best, where they dress different than they dress the rest of the week, and we'll go to church that way and things like that. But there is a sense in which we kind of prepare. Maybe even you say to yourself with some level of restraint, I know I'm going to get home a little earlier on Saturday night because, you know, Sunday morning comes early and I want to be ready for church, or maybe you don't. And maybe you even will say to things about, you know, well, we don't do as much on Saturday night because we want to be fresh for Sunday morning, or maybe not. But, you know, here's the deal is that for the Israelites, they understood the nature of this moment because from the very first time they ever go to church, they get really clear instructions. That they are to be pure, and that they are to be holy, and that they're to prepare themselves. And not only are they to prepare themselves, but he says this thing that I could have had a lot of fun with, but I'm married and I know better. It says this, and not go near a woman. What he means is no sex. because ceremonially you will be unclean and you won't be able to approach the Lord. Can you imagine? I imagine if you like said that in churches all across the United States of America, church attendance would probably drop by half. That was supposed to be funny. And yet the reality is that they so desired to know who God was and to be near him that, yeah, they were willing. See, sometimes I think we kind of undersell God. We kind of give this impression sometimes is that poor God, he just needs us to come to, oh, won't you please come to Jesus? Oh, please. And we beg and prod and plead with people. And, you know, there's another side to it. That he's an awesome, terrifying God. And short of his grace and mercy and relationship with him, we're toast. We don't like to talk about that part. But there is a real terrifying reality to it that sometimes we really ought to put in check our kind of laissez-faire attitude and ask ourselves the question, who do we think we're approaching? I have to remind myself of that sometimes because, you know, being a vineyard guy and we wear blue jeans and we're always, you know, talking about intimacy with God and the grace of God and the kindness of God. And I love all those things about God. Don't misunderstand me. Please do not hear, don't let the pendulum swing to the other end. But there is a point in the fact that he is God, that he's awesome and terrifying and able and that he deserves respect. You know, that thing that we used to give our parents. You know, I remember growing up in Texas, and my brother-in-law was from Boston. My sister met him in the Navy, and they couldn't find a job in Boston, and so they moved to El Paso, Texas. My dad was vice president of El Paso Natural Gas and Oil in the land department, and so he told my brother-in-law, I can get you a job. You come down here, we'll get you a job. So they packed up everything and they moved across country to El Paso, Texas. My dad set up all the interviews and he came home that night. And my dad said, well, okay, which job did you end up with? He goes, I didn't get any of them. I said, what do you mean you didn't get any of them? My dad's thinking to himself, somebody's head's going to roll because I set up these job interviews. I'm vice president of the land department. Somebody was supposed to hire my son-in-law and he gets on the phone. He makes a few phone calls. He goes in the next day. And I'm watching my dad's countenance go down, 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 down. And I know my daddy well enough to know that's a bad thing. By the time he gets home that evening, I can see the boiling. He had a bald head and it was red whenever he was mad. So you didn't have to wonder if you were in trouble. And he was sitting there waiting for my brother-in-law with a red head. And I thought, wow, what did he do? And my dad says to him, son, when you were talking to those people, did you ever say yes, sir, or no, sir, when you were talking to those people? He goes, I'm better than them. I don't have to say sir. And my dad says, let me tell you in no uncertain terms, boy, I'm better than you, and I call you sir. You're lucky to be in my house. So lose your attitude and realize that you're in the South now and we say yes, sir, and no, sir, and yes, ma'am, and no, ma'am, and it doesn't make you better or worse except if you don't say them. So go in to those interviews tomorrow and you say yes, sir, and no, sir, and you come home with a job. Or you can be homeless and jobless in El Paso, Texas, because I'm not going to put up with it. You ever watch a 30-year-old man go and beg for a job? Pretty sad. But I watched my brother-in-law go back and use yes, sir, and no, sir, and what do you know? He came home with a pretty nice job. You know, respect matters to people. And it so happens it matters to God. You see, God's our friend, and he loves us, and he's kind and merciful to us. But there is a point in the fact that they were learning about respecting God. You know, when I first started going to church, there's a lot of things I just really didn't get, and it was really hard for me to understand. There's a lot of kind of unspoken things, and I always tried to make a really warm environment for people to learn those things in a non-judgmental way. But I got to tell you that there does come a point where we have to open our mouths and talk to people about the fact that God is worthy of our respect. And that when we take an attitude like that he's not worthy or that I'm not going to do this or do that, I really struggle with that. Because the fact is that he's God. He's God. And the idea of being flippant with him, gosh, I wouldn't be flippant with my dad. I wouldn't be flippant with my mom. I might disagree with them sometimes, but I will do so respectfully. I tell my kids, you're welcome to disagree with me as long as you do it respectfully. And there's this real sense in which I'm standing before the Almighty God that somewhere in there that we need to come to the realization that he is God and I'm not. I think it's important for us, especially as a people who preach and teach about grace and mercy, because we don't want people to fear God in the negative sense, thinking that he's always waiting to squish us or to do us harm. But I do think that there's a point in being, learning to be respectful and teaching people to respect God, that he should get our full attention, that there is something valuable about stopping our otherworldly activities to pay attention to the Lord. You see, all of life is worship, and yet the truth is that if you and I don't ever stop to do what we're doing right now, if everything is worship, then nothing is worship. There is a sense in which when we pause and we sing songs and we gather together and we encourage one another and we break bread together, we have communion and we do all of these things, that there's a sense of transcendence that grabs our heart and our attention and draws us into the presence of God in a way that doesn't happen just driving along in the car or sitting by the lakeside or whatever. Those things are wonderful. Don't misunderstand me. I love all those things. I went camping this week. I had a good time. And I really did sense the presence of God. When I play that worship CD in my car and I'm singing along, I really sometimes have great worship experiences. When I'm gathered together with my friends, last night, being at a wedding and just thinking about the conversations I was having with people that I knew at that wedding and thinking to myself that God takes joy in those conversations, that they are like prayers before him, that he likes to see us speak well to one another and be kind to one another, and that God is present in that too. There's no lack of places where God is, because God is everywhere. And yet, Israel is being taught that there is a time and a place to stop all manner of other activity, even sex, long enough to cleanse themselves, consecrate themselves, get their focus and attention, and give God 100% from right in here and say, you know what, God, it is all about you in this moment, coming into your presence. Can you imagine what worship could be like if everybody in the room came 100% committed to get into his presence? See, when I say that, I'm just as guilty. I mean, I'm the guy that only got 4 hours of sleep last night. You know, there's something about whenever I come in, plenty of sleep and refreshed and my mind stayed on God and I've gotten up in the morning and prayed and spent some time with the Lord and I come in, and I just had this so much more amazing encounter with God. You know, it's amazing that when I get those nights like that, that the worship team's all so much better, that the preaching is so much better. You can smile about that. Do you know what I'm saying? There's a point in taking time to honor and respect God. Secondly, these people don't know how to live with God. They are clueless about life with God. Actually, we're going to talk more about this over the next few weeks. We're going to talk about the Ten Commandments. Then we're going to talk about some of the things that God does to make application of the law. But here's the thing is that ask yourself this question. what do you and I really know about living with God? I mean, know, not feel or think, or what do we know about living with God? You see, each one of us has our ideas about what God is like, who he is, how we think he ought to be approached, but the truth is that he's God, and I'm not. And so my ideas, my concepts, my thoughts about that are really my own. But in a way, you know, I heard it said one time this way, and at first I took a little offense, but as I paused and thought about it for a moment, I thought, no, you know, there's truth to that. And so we were all having this conversation about God and who God is and what we think about God and how we approach God. And one person said in the midst of it, who cares what you think? And we all went, what? You were just participating in this conversation just a moment ago. You know, you apparently thought God cared about what you thought, you know. And he goes, no, that's just my point. You know, here I am talking to you about what I think and all that, about what God is like and how you should approach God and things like that. But he says there's a real sense in which, who cares what I think? Who cares what I think? Because I can think all day long and be dead wrong. I can approach God in a way that is actually offensive to him and just need his grace and his mercy to cover me in spite of what I thought was the right way to approach him. And I thought about that whole thing. At first, like I said, I was very offended, but the more I thought about it, the more I thought, you know, who cares what I think? And I began to kind of just scour the Word of God for things about worship and connecting with God. And I found out that a lot of the things I believed really were based in the Scriptures, that I really had read those things and discovered those things. But I also realized that along the way that there was a lot of chaff in what I thought about approaching God, that it was just really more my ideas or being raised as an American or being raised in a contemporary church or whatever else, and that our ideas about who God, what God is like and who he is, really don't matter nearly as much as what God has revealed to us about himself. You see, if I think about it, I really hardly even know how to approach you or my wife or my kids on any given day. There are times when you ever said this? I don't know how to go about that. I don't know how to approach this person. I don't know how to go about approaching this subject matter with them or whatever else. There are times where I find myself absolutely bewildered about how to approach another human being. And I'm a fairly social person, but there's just times when I recognize that I don't know what's going on in that the mind of that person. I don't know what things have happened leading up to these events. All I know is I'm in this situation. And then I recognize that there is a holy God who is without sin. Without sin. Have you ever thought about that? That God is holy and without sin? How do you approach a holy God who is without sin? How do you make connection with a God who is so wholly other and yet desires to make connection with you and I? And it's a regular question I get asked, how do you connect with God? Some people mean in terms of prayer. Some people mean it in terms of worship. You know, one of the things that there was a study done, it was done about 20 years ago, and then they've revised the study every 5 years. And they did a study of denominations in America and independent churches in America. And what they found is that less than 15% of people actually said that they had had more than one time in worship where they connected with God. Hear that? Isn't that staggering? Less than 15% of regular churchgoers said that they had connected with God more than once in time of worship. What was really astounding is that 60% said they had never had an encounter with God in worship. In other words, they were going to church on a regular basis, and they thought God didn't care. They felt no connection. They knew nothing but church attendance. Now, now. You go denomination by denomination, you find, like in Assembly of God churches, they have a tendency to have a higher percentage. Like 70% of the people say that they've had connections with God multiple times in the course of worship and things like that, very praise and oriented type of worship and things like that. And you can go down to other denominations like Episcopalian, for instance, our good friends that we prayed for this morning, and less than 15% said that they had ever had an encounter with God in any way. Doesn't that grab your attention? You see, if we in church know so much about how to connect with God, then how is it that even like in an Assembly of God church that has extensive praise and worship, that 30% still don't ever connect with God? Maybe it's the way we're going about it. Maybe it's a lack of wanting to know what it is that God wants to connect with us over. Maybe it's a lack of time spent with him. Maybe we've just never taught people. You know what I bet? I bet it's that we haven't taught people very well. But honestly, part of the reason we don't teach oftentimes is because the sense is that nobody wants to know. I mean, if I should start to tell you how you to connect with God, there's a good chance that you might tell me that's just my opinion. Right? So here we have this whole encounter, and Israel really knows nothing about God, and in that moment, God gives Moses instructions and tells him, consecrate yourselves, clear your hearts, clear your minds, cleanse your bodies, cleanse your soul, cleanse your mind, and then come with a sense of recognition of who God is. Have an awareness of his awesome nature. And then, connect with who God is. It's really powerful instructions. I still believe in the whole thing of intimacy, and we're going to teach some of that over the next couple of weeks and some things he's going to show us, but I do think there's a real point in where we come to and stop and think about, how do I move beyond my naive Gentile way of looking at God and stop acting like a pagan and become a real follower of God? How do I transform my life so that I'm regularly connecting and knowing the presence and the power of a God who loved them enough not only to be the holy God on the mountain, but came near even as there was danger? You know, it's real easy to just kind of focus on this, that God set the boundaries and everything else, and to say, wow, terrifying, wow, that's scary, and wow, that's a... But here's the thing, that God knew the whole situation. He knew about how far off they were. He knew about how clueless they were. He knew about the dangers of them coming near. And yet, God wanted so much to be near that he came near. He came to them on the mountain. He came to them when they were in Egypt. He comes to them and he says, and he even says to them, bring the priest up on the mountain. And Moses says, but Lord, you said, and he goes, well, okay, bring just Aaron. But it is the desire, it's the heart, it's the passion of God in this moment when there's every reason for people to be afraid and to maybe even run, that God is saying, no, 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 come near, come near, come near. Don't do anything foolish, but come near. It's the way of God that he will eventually establish the temple in the city, in his city, and make a way for people to come near to him. It will be the way that when Jesus is standing in the court of the Gentiles and they're selling things, and the Gentiles, the nations, can't get into the court of the Gentiles to worship, and he will turn everything over and wreak havoc on that on the people in that day, of the Jewish people that day, to make room for the nations, to make room for the Gentiles. It is the heart and the nature of God that he would send his very own son. Ephesians 1 says that before the foundations of the earth were poured, before the Spirit of God was moving over the earth, which was formless and void, before any of that, it says that he purposed us in Christ Jesus. It means he looked through the hallways of time before he ever made a one of us. And he saw the wars and the rumors of wars and the difficulties and the hardship. And he says, I want that so bad. I want them so bad. I will put myself and I will put my son through all of that so that we can dwell together. So that we can be in relationship with one another. And so I have to take those two things. I take this whole thing of where God is holy, other, and awesome and terrible and frightening and needs to be respected. And I look at the other hand and I go, God is so merciful and desirous of our presence and everything that he will do everything, even put his son on a cross. I recognize that God is so big and so willing at the same time. But then again, would you really want a God that's so small that you can explain everything about him? So that's our invitation. It's to come before a God who is awesome and powerful, able to overcome our enemies, able to overcome the world, to speak life and light into existence, and who is so tender that he would withhold nothing from us, not even his very own son. You see, when he was looking through the window at you and he couldn't touch because of our sin, he said, I'm going to make a way. And so he touched us with Jesus.